Have you ever left the doctor's office thinking, maybe it is just me? Or you're in the middle of an appointment and you're being told you're much too young for that to happen. Your labs are totally normal. Your anatomy looks just fine. You know what you need to do? You need to get a date night. You need to go away for a weekend. You need to get some pretty lingerie. You need to relax. You need to have a glass of wine. That will fix all the issues that you're having in your sexual health or other parts of your life. If this resonates with you, if you're thinking that has been me at some point, this episode is for you. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman. I'm a sex med gynecologist. I'm a menopause expert in downtown Chicago. And I have to tell you that after thousands of patients and over two decades as a board-certified OBGYN, and after over a decade as someone in the sexual medicine and menopause space, a specialist in this field, I am beginning to believe more and more that looking at what we're dealing with in women's health, the crises in women's health, the major issues isn't the fact that we don't have treatments for all diseases or cures for all diseases or research in all the diseases that we have to deal with. But I think one of our biggest obstacles is actually simply stated as dismissal. This is something I really feel to my core. This is something that has fueled my reason for doing this podcast, for my reason for being on social media, for my reason for writing the book that I'm going to talk about. Because I do think, and I've said this, and I go to different OBGYN departments and I talk about this, that dismissal in women's healthcare is harmful. So, welcome to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about dismissal in healthcare, in women's health specifically. I'm going to start with a personal story, actually. The truth is, I've been an OBGYN for over two decades. You know, I have not only thought about patients that I've dismissed, which I'll talk about, but I've also been on the other side of the dismissal equation, where I've been in the hospital. I have a very clear example in my head. There's so many, actually, but I have a very clear example in my head of, I had a preterm birth with my first two children, actually, which I could talk about separately as a problem within the women's health and medical system, dealing with, how we treat women in medicine, because that is a whole separate story. But what I want to say is in my first pregnancy, went early. I delivered early, about 6.5 weeks early. And I was in the hospital, my own hospital, in Chicago. And I was there getting ready in active labor after contracting for weeks. And finally in active labor, and I was getting my epidural. And, as a typical in academic hospital, the resident tries and the fellow may try and then the attending tries. So by the time I think it was my third stick, trying to get my epidural to numb the nerves that innervate my pelvis so that I don't feel the contractions as much. I was getting the epidural. Finally, I think the third try, they got it. I was finally, pain-free for a short period of time until I had to get it, re-upped during my delivery. And the next day on rounds, you get rounded on by the OBGYN team. So you get rounded on by the medical student, the resident, and the attending, hopefully, within the obstetrics team. But you also, if you have an anesthetic anesthesia done, interventional anesthesia done, you will have a rounding done by the anesthesia team. So in the morning, they asked me if I was having the typical symptoms that they worry about. Are you having any numbness or tingling still? Any issues with weakness in your legs? Yes, I am. Are you having any headaches? Yes, I am. Are you feeling, all the things, everything they said, I said yes. And they're like, okay, sure. And I was like, well, it's really uncomfortable. I don't know if you can do something about this. The resident checked off some boxes and left. The whole day goes by. I had a severe headache, really unable to bond with my child. I was really uncomfortable, couldn't really walk either because of the issues I was having with the anesthetic and the prolonged effects that were happening. Long story short, I had all these complaints. No one attended to them. My own hospital, I'm an OBGYN at that hospital. No one's attending to my complaints. Happened to have my older brother there who was visiting to see the birth of, to be there for, to see his nephew. And, he is a urologic surgeon. And, he was like, why aren't they, why haven't they come back to see you? And, what's going on here? As someone that's in the hospital system, you know how hospitals work, you know how academic centers work. And you know that this is not normal. Like, this wouldn't have happened if it was like, me asking for it or whatever, right? Like, this wouldn't have happened. And so he finally called the attending, or the resident who talked to the attending, and then finally got, someone there. And by like midnight that evening, I was getting a blood patch done. Separate question, separate issue altogether. But, I finally got attended to, almost 12 hours, more than 12 hours later. So the point of that story is really that I had complaints. I got ignored. This was my own hospital. I'm an OBGYN. I can navigate the system. I was still ignored. I was still dismissed until I had an advocate who happened to be male who was in the system, understanding how the medical healthcare system works, who forced the care to happen, actually. So dismissal is common, right? I'm just saying that like bias is common, dismissal is common. Systems are in place, to help prevent sort of catastrophic things from happening, but not good enough, right? Because we still have a very three times the maternal mortality in Black women than we do in Caucasian women. We still have, people that are having issues with pain or other things and being neglected. We still have people that are medically gaslit for vulvovaginal pain. This is happening across the board. And so I think this is really like the biggest obstacle I think we need to overcome, one of the biggest obstacles we need to overcome in medicine. And that is just like dismissing vulva owners more than anything else, honestly. But, this story makes me think about the fact that, again, my brother had to say, you're not listening to my sister. And I needed, another male physician to advocate for me, and I got the help I needed. What happens to the average patient? And that's why, again, that's why we have this higher maternal mortality rates and higher issues. I think about even someone like Sabrina Williams, who was having a pulmonary embolus and was getting not the care that she needed. And so as I reflect upon this, I think about those stories. I also think about myself as a clinician who may have been someone that did not do the right thing and did dismiss patients, right? And I think about the fact when I used to be in a system where I had to see 30 or 40 patients a day. And you're in a system, you have to see all these patients. And what happens is, I had to see, about 30 OB patients and about 10 GYN patients. And you see what happens when these patients come in over and over again. You're crunched for time. You're being forced to see more and more. And then if a patient that is not the typical routine patient without complaints, without any significant concerns, you get into trouble. And that's why we have this system in place that is failing women, right? I think that, if you have 15 minutes and someone has complex vulvovaginal pain or persistent genital arousal or perimenopause and menopause, you can't assess that in a 10 or 15 minute visit, That's why a lot of the telehealth platforms are failing as well, because they're trying to actually, push the envelope and see more patients, and you can't do it. You can't provide good care that way. So you're in a system. So I always feel bad because, when you see those patients, said pelvic pain or sexual pain, it would upset me because I, number one, didn't know how to treat them. I wasn't taught like in medical school or residency. I had to go learn from Ishwish and my mentors and all the other things. And have become an expert just from exploring this on my own, being part of these communities and my like now more than decade of experience. But, this is not something that we learned. And, the truth is, I would say like probably over the last decade is when we've gotten so much more information. So because I graduated, so long ago, of course, we didn't learn stuff that wasn't even like relevant at the time or, discoverable at the time. And so that's one issue. And the other issue is, yeah, I mean, guess what? Like, it's really hard to see that many patients and still get your notes done and do the prior authorizations and call in your refills and do all the things that you're supposed to do and, you know, still get home, you know, and have dinner or whatever you want to do. You know, like, it was really, really, really challenging. And so that's why a lot of patients who suffer from vulvovaginal disease and suffer from, you know, all these pain disorders, they know that there's a terminology for the patients that are so not algorithmic, right? When you have a patient that doesn't follow an algorithm, which most patients don't, hello, you know, nuanced medicine, it goes beyond algorithms and understanding. Like, so I think that's the problem. It's like you have urgent cares and ERs and things like that, which have to follow algorithms because of their volume. But it shouldn't be that way in an outpatient setting, right? We should really provide nuanced care based on the patient that we're seeing in front of us. And so those patients know, and there's a term for that, was called a heart sink patient, where the clinician's heart would sink seeing the diagnosis or possible chief complaint because the system wasn't preparing them to treat the patients, nor do they have the time or ability to treat those patients. And so we have sort of this bigger issue of the system. And it's always say medicine's really good at treating disease, but somewhere along the line in trying to treat the disease processes, we've siloed and super specialized in such a way that sometimes we miss the forest for the trees, right? So I used to joke that I'm a doctor that treats from the belly button to the thighs, and that's it. Like, I'm like, I don't know any of that stuff. But now I'm not. I actually, like, really work hard to know other things because hormone medicine is full body medicine, right? So if I'm treating perimenopause and menopause, I can't just treat the genital urinary system. I got to know what's happening to your bones. I got to know what's happening to your cardiovascular system. I got to know what's happening to your brain. I got to know all that stuff. And I might not be able to do this most super specialized things, but I can do preventative things. I can treat things that are starting to evolve and all the things. And I can look for things and diagnose things. So the fact that we've siloed medicine so much and we're not seeing the full person in front of us really contributes to the dismissal in our fields. You know, hormones go to one person, the vulva goes to another person, the mental health goes to the other person. And guess who ends up with that person back in their office usually? It's the OBGYNs, because most of the time it's women and they're like, oh, you need to go see your OBGYN, right? And so we can learn to do a lot of things in this profession, but we are under the bus. I mean, we're getting thrown under the bus these days on social media and other things because, yeah, truthfully, a lot of OBGYNs have dismissed their patients because of all the things I'm talking about. They have to go run and do a delivery. They have to do all these things. And it's not easy to navigate more elaborate conditions. You know, we don't follow algorithmic medicine, nor should anyone really, except if you're really trying to push volume out into the world. So, you know, when you think about dismissal and you think about how we silo care and we think about how, you know, your gut reaction, whether or not it's racist or sexist, will come to the forefront. This is actually, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote the book that I did. Okay. I wrote a book. It's coming out October 6th called Brown Girls Disease, A Guide to Sexual Health and Empowerment Through a South Asian Lens. And people wonder, oh, it's a book for South Asian women. It is. It's also a book for anyone that is navigating sexual health concerns. It's also a book for anyone that's been part of the groups that are heavily dismissed in women's health, right? Because Brown Girls Disease is a name and a phrase that had been given to patients who were of South Asian descent, who could not tolerate penetration, who could not tolerate sex, who could not tolerate speculum exams, who could not tolerate pelvic exams. So flippantly, nurses, medical assistants, doctors, all other clinicians in hospital settings many times would flippantly say, oh, patient in room 4, Brown Girls disease, watch out. You know, it's just like when I was in the ER and people would talk about, you know, the Latina patient, like, oh, hysterical Hispanic room in room 3. Oh, another, you know, whatever racist trope you want to talk about. These were the kind of things that engulfed some of our training. And I can tell you, as a first-year intern in OBGYN, I was starting my internship. We were on the OB rotation. I was with an attending. We had a very high South Asian population at the time, particularly going to certain practices. And there were patients, yeah, you know, 40% of South Asian women at some point, you know, have penetrative disorders. Okay, so it's not uncommon. It is a common situation. But when medicine fails to acknowledge that there are issues at play that they can evaluate, they blame the patient, right? You're calling it brown girls' disease is blaming the patient. It's not looking for the answer. It's dismissing their problem as something that only affects your people. In fact, my attending told me that. I was in a room with an attending, with a patient who was in labor. She was in a lot of pain. She was struggling. And, you know, the patient could never tolerate pelvic exams. And so she was trying to examine her cervix to see, at that time, you could only get an epidural if you had reached like 4 centimeters dilation or whatever, right? Like you couldn't get your epidural ahead of time. And so people had to know the exam before. And this was, you know, circa 2001 or two, right? So she tried to do the exam. She couldn't do the exam. She could tell she's pissed off. Like she's tired. You know, the day has gotten to her. She kind of rolls her eyes at this patient. She walks out of the room and she says, looks at me dead in the face and was like, what's the deal with your people? They act like they've never had anything in the vagina. Like, what? I was an intern back then. You didn't speak back to your attendings. You just took whatever they gave you. And if they handed you your ass, you would take it, because that's what happened. That's what it was, a very like military-esque sort of like situation, right? We didn't talk back to attendings. We couldn't really report people, all the things. And so she said that to me. I was shocked. I was speechless. I was like, oh. And I felt bad for that patient. Like, oh my God, is she saying this to me? What is she saying to the rest of the people that she deals with that are brown? And so, and then I later heard from other OBGYNs who were also South Asian about this terminology, brown girl's disease. And it was very clear to me that even in my own hospital, people were like, oh, we got a girl in there. She can't tolerate, you know, pelvic exams. Another brown girl with the same problem, right? So here we are. We're acknowledging, you know, potentially there are cultural factors involved, but you're blaming the patient. You're not actually assessing her. You're not actually trying to figure out, you know, what is happening in her genital pelvic world. Is it hormonal? Is it nerve endings? Is it musculoskeletal? Is it all of the above and you need to treat it, right? But no, you're just saying, oh, she's a brown girl who can't tolerate it. So I called it brown girl's disease because, well, number one, I'm reclaiming the term. Number two, like, it's a dismissive term that was used to describe a population of people that did struggle with sexual issues and sexual pain. And so in my book, I actually describe other issues like, you know, just so you guys know, the first, you know, part of it is foundations, what nobody taught you about your body's changes, and then sex and culture for brown girls. We talk about sort of how religion and culture and colonization and all of these things interplay to, you know, really contribute to sexual dysfunction. And then there are the three elephants in the room, which are like medical bias and, you know, implicit bias, mental health disorders and trauma. So we know that. And so I think it's a great book. I think you guys will enjoy it. But this is why I wrote the book. You know, the book is about, I'll read you the in the cover what it says. In Brown Girl's Disease, ? Dr. Smina Rahman calls for change in a system failing to meet all women's needs by exploring the intersection of gender, culture, religion, and medicine. More than a medical resource, Brown Girl's Disease equips women with the tools they need to cover topics rarely discussed, including vaginismus, persistent genital arousal disorder, libido, and arousal concerns. Learn how trauma, medical bias, and psychological conditions impact sexual dysfunction and how to navigate postpartum, perimenopause, and menopause. Discover the 5 most common sexual health conditions and gain a safe space for finding answers to the questions you've been asked, you've been too afraid to ask. Women deserve care that meets them without judgment. Learn how to reclaim your body, your choices, and your right to compassionate care. This is a description of what's happening in my book, honestly. And for me, you know, even the fact that like I can give words and terminology to your anatomy, right? Like a patient's going to learn about their vulvar vestibule and their clitoral hood, and they're going to learn all the terms that they just refer to as down there. And we're going to talk about why people call it down there and that shame that's shrouded in our own anatomy that really prohibits us from getting the care we need. Because if you can't name your part, what if I just went to the doctor and said, it hurts up here? Well, where up here? Is it hurting in your eyes? Is it hurting in your nose? Is it hurting in your mouth? I don't know. It just hurts up here. Like, you'd never do that. You would use anatomic terms, right? And that's why we should use anatomic terms for what's happening in your genital pelvic area. And these diagnoses and these words matter. The first time I told a patient who had been struggling with a persistent genital arousal disorder for 20 plus years, she was crying in my office. And I said, oh, well, you know what? You have a condition called persistent genital arousal disorder. She started bawling. She was like, you mean there's a name to something that I'm experiencing? Like, I'm not going crazy? And I was like, yeah, there's a name for it. And we have actually a roadmap on how to treat it. We know how we can treat it. It takes time sometimes to treat it, but we know what to do. You know, the same with lichen sclerosis and genital urinary syndrome and menopause. We changed the name to vulvovaginal atrophy and from senile vagina to genital urinary syndrome menopause, because it's just not about the vulva and vagina. It's about your urinary tract too. And so these words matter. And we call that affect labeling. It automatically brings your nervous system down, knowing that you have something that has a definition and a potential treatment. That, yeah, guess what? This is not all in my head. But sometimes it can be part of it in your head, right? Sometimes we know if you have chronic vulvar conditions and genital pelvic pain, yeah, you might as well know that you're probably going to get anxious and depressed. And this is something that happens to people who suffer from chronic diseases, right? We know this. And so this is why I wanted to introduce this podcast today, to introduce the concept of dismissal in medicine and how dangerous it is, and talk about how my book is definitely, definitely centering women of color. But it is really a book for all women. It is really a book for any clinician who doesn't really have a good understanding of how to treat sexual health issues, because it's kind of like a 101 primer. You know, we talk about everything on, you know, evaluation and treatments for some of these things: perimenopause, menopause, postpartum, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, all the things. So really, I want to just say that for me, I want you guys to have an understanding of this so you can feel empowered, so you don't get dismissed, so you can work within a system that is failing women, but you don't have to be part of that failure, right? You can at least come empowered and understanding what's happening and why the sociocultural and religious factors that are at play probably are also contributing to what's happening to you, and why, you know, racism and sexism and all the isms are also contributing to what's happening to you, and why your biology and your pelvic floor and your brain and your hormones are also contributing to what's happening to you. But there are just aspects that we just haven't named, right? And so for me, of course, I loved this book. My daughter was like, well, you know, what do you think is going to happen when people, you know, get your book? And I was like, well, hopefully they feel empowered. Really, I want them to. And she was like, yeah, but people aren't going to buy a book called Brown Girls Disease. And I'm like, well, they should and they might. I mean, if they understand that this is just more about, you know, empowering yourself, and it is, you know, centering the voices of the unheard, but also just like all women and the conditions they treat. And she was like, well, so what, do you want to be a bestseller? And I was like, well, heck yeah. You know, you always dream of being a bestseller and that people resonate, the book resonates with a lot of people. But it's more than just that. It's like, I hope for us to now say that this terminology, Brown Girls Disease, is going to be really outdated, that this idea of dismissing women because of what they look like or where they're from or what condition we think they have or how much pain is experienced in their genitals, or, you know, the fact that this is somehow related to your sexual organs and we dismiss them because of that, I hope that that becomes outdated. And I hope that we can start a movement of eliminating dismissal, really stopping the chronic process of people not believing women, right? So my mission is very simple. I really want women to feel seen, heard, and believed. And to be honest with you, I really want, at the end of the day, I really want to hear from you guys too. You know, leave me comments. Let me know, like, how were you dismissed? If you were dismissed, you know, how that make you feel? How long did it take you to get the help you need? I want to hear your story, not because I need more stories, because I hear these stories every day, but because we need to understand how pervasive this is and how we need to make this idea of dismissing women's healthcare outdated. We need to believe in what women are saying and try to improve their quality of life, their longevity, and all the things, so that we won't have this issues for the next generation, right? This is what we want to do. We want to move forward in life. We want to keep progressing. So yeah, just drop me your story. Tell me what's up. Tell me what's going on. And I hope you join the movement to end dismissal. I really do. And that's my verdict for you today. Like, let us have you guys join the mission to end dismissal. But that's it. That's all I want to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about why I wrote this book. I want to talk to you about what the book entails. And really, I want to talk to you about starting a movement, that we need to start this movement to end dismissal. You can find my book available on pre-order on Amazon. I will be releasing where I'll be in terms of, you know, this book tour that I'm going on. And I will be hitting, hopefully, North Carolina, like Charlotte, Raleigh, Durham. I'm going to be going to Boston area. I'm going to be going to New York City, Chicago, of course, hopefully Atlanta, hopefully San Francisco Bay Area, and then Southern California as well. And yeah, I think those are the big areas. And then hopefully Ohio, I'm going to try to go to Cleveland, and I'm going to try to go to a few other areas locally. So stay tuned, and I hope to meet you guys in person. Well, I want to see you. And I hope we can all like join a movement to improve women's health. So I'm Dr. Sabina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next week. If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.